Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Cindy F. Solomon with the Global Product Management Talk. Today is June 17th, Monday in the United States. I'm delighted to be with you today. You are listening to the Global Product Management Talk, available at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. Follow us there to get updates of upcoming episodes and our archive of over 100 talks with experts and professionals passionate about products, business process, product management, startups, marketing, innovation, and excellence. Today we are talking with Ed Brill, who is an IBM executive and an author of Opting In, about becoming the social product manager. And before we get there, let me give a shout-out to thank our sponsors, the AIPMM, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management, which promotes worldwide excellence in product management education with training, certification credentials, professional networking opportunities available in over 65 countries. It is the worldwide certifying body of product team professionals and is forwarding the emerging professional product management with the forthcoming product management body of knowledge, the PodBoc. Follow them on Twitter at AIPMM and on the web at AIPMM.com and check out their excellent webinar series. By the way, you can follow us at PRODMGMTTALK on Twitter. We started out as a Twitter chat. And a shout-out to our listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area, Startup Product Talks, and in the Boston area, and our international participants. You can also find out more about us at www.prodmgmttalk. Thank you to Sprintly. Don't ask how it's going. Watch how it's going with Sprintly. Find them on the web at sprint.ly. Sprint.ly is project management software that brings in the entire corporation to the software development process by showing managers and non-engineers a top-level view of what the programmers are doing. Again, that's Sprint.ly. Thank you to BrainMates.com, boosting people and product performance. Subscribe to their newsletter, read popular brain rants, learn about their consulting and mentoring approach to forward your product management career and methods. Ask BrainMates. Fonsumo solves the headaches of managing conferences and other events and allows you to focus on relationships and sales. Sign up for a trial account at fonsumo.com. That's F-O-N-S-U-M-O.com. Startup Product is a movement for product excellence through cross-discipline collaboration and a holistic product perspective. There is a life cycle that every product, startup, idea, and project passes through to be realized. Focusing on where the product is in its life cycle enables a conversation that brings us all together on what will serve the product most to arrive at product market fit, sustain growth, and generate revenue streams. The purpose of the startup is to not continue to be a startup, but to scale. The Startup Product Summit, SF2, is happening on October 11, 2013, in San Francisco. Go to startupproduct.com and register before June 24th for $400 off the registration. It is a full-day lineup of over 20 speakers who are product professionals with different perspectives on product management, on product development, product experience, customer experience, a whole range of the team and what it takes to arrive at product excellence. That's at startupproduct.com. Thank you to Blame Sally, who provides the music. Usually I'm recording out of a studio, Studio 132 in the Oakland Hills in California. Currently, I am in Chicago. It is beautiful. It is beautiful weather here. What a gorgeous city. I'm looking out the window from the Hyatt Regency on the 19th floor, and what a view. So this is Cindy F. Solomon, by the way, your host. I'm at Cindy F. Solomon. Delighted to be here today with you from beautiful Chicago. So today we're talking about the Social Product Manager. Social business tools can help product and brand managers to become more engaged, transparent, and agile, leading to better business outcomes. Our speaker today, Ed Brill, has been involved with IBM's social business journey, inserting social into business processes and connecting people with people to deliver faster innovation, better responsiveness, and increased customer satisfaction. By the way, if you'd like to call in to speak with us, with myself and Ed Brill, and I do see that someone has called in, but guess what? I don't have an engineer to screen your call, so I'm going to bring you in, and you're welcome to talk in a minute. Hold on after we bring Ed on. So Ed Brill is Director of Social Business and Collaboration Solutions for IBM. He's responsible for the product and market strategy for IBM's messaging, collaboration, communications, and productivity products, including Lotus Notes and Domino, IBM Smart Cloud Notes, IBM SameTime, Lotus Symphony, IBM Docs, and other related social business solutions. His focus is on extending and growing the success of these solutions through customer engagement, partner ecosystem development, and harnessing the breadth and depth of the IBM organization. Ed is the author of the IBM Press book, Opting In, Lessons in Social Business from a Fortune 500 Product Manager, which was published recently in January. Please follow Ed at Ed Brill, E-D-B-R-I-L-L, and let me tell you about the book he wrote, Opting In, Lessons in Social Business from a Fortune 500 Product Manager. In Opting In, you learn how to be successful in social business based on the strategy and lessons learned as IBM adopted a culture of transformation and engagement. Brill candidly shares the best practices, challenges, and results of IBM's social business transformation. Opting In outlines the process of becoming social business through organizational commitment, cultural change, the right tools, and a strategy for engagement. He helps readers develop individual strategies and a roadmap for using social business tools from time and place considerations, volume and amplification, offense and defense considerations through building an army of advocates. Excellent. So you're listening to the Global Product Management Talk. You're welcome to call in at 323-927-2957. Follow us at PRODMGMTTALK. And if you're tweeting, please use the hashtag PRODMGMTTALK, and I will see you out on Twitter to include you in the conversation. Ed, are you there?
I am here. Thank you, Cindy.
Yay! Thank you. So, before we went live, you were telling me that you're also in Chicago, and if you didn't tell me that the weather was not beautiful like this all the time, I would be moving here. It is just exquisite.
Yeah, well, sorry, in the winter it does get a little colder than this, but we have finally brought out the summer. So.
Yeah, and you can tell, I mean, people are just so happy walking around. Everyone is so friendly. I'll tell you, I'm also a foodie. I've had some great food here. So
I think that's an unspoken thing about Chicago. It's probably one of the top three or four eating towns in America. So there you go.
Yeah, so besides a deep dish pizza, what else should we look for?
I'm a fan of Paul Kahn's restaurants, which are Publican, Avec, Big Star Tacos, and Blackbird is the other one. Sorry, that's the fine dining one. But Publican's are our all-time favorite in the city right now. And then Rick Bayless's Shoko for Mexican street food, his interpretation. That's a really good one. So.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad we're recording this, so don't have to take notes. So, great. So I'm very excited because what you're involved in is what I would traditionally call product marketing. So why don't you give us some context and wherever you want to start, a lot of our listeners are interested in product management, or certainly they care about product excellence. Who doesn't care?
Right.
But why don't you give us a bridge into exactly what is a social product manager, and how did you arrive at that?
Yeah, I mean, a social product manager is a product manager who understands the value of participation, but it requires us to be on a common page about what a product manager is to understand that definition. And as we practice the discipline here at IBM, the product line manager is the business owner for a product or service, the person who's worried about the traditional four P's of marketing, but also the financial plan, the product features, the release cycles, sort of the overall business owner of a product or service or brand within the organization, who then in turn works with marketing on routes and demand, and then also works with sales and execution. So, and then with the development teams to build it, of course. So that's kind of how I view product management, sitting fairly close to the center of the circle of activity. And so a social product manager is somebody who's using all of the tools available to them in the modern palette of social networking to get input and share information both inside their organization but also externally as well.
Excellent. Thank you. So that's exactly how I see it. You have the resources in a big organization to have all these departments and to have the various designations. A lot of times in smaller organizations, certainly in startups, the product manager has to do everything and doesn't have any other departments.
They're washing
that information.
Washing the dishes at night too. Yeah, no, I think it is an amalgam of release management, project management, marketing. There's a lot of different disciplines that go into product management. Deal closer, it can be just about everything.
Right. Now, how is there any agile processes that you're interfacing with?
Well, our development organizations and IBM are big fans of Agile, and a lot of the products that you see us bringing to market today are built that way, so that we're on, in our mobile space, for example, we're on quarterly release cycles with our mobile application development platform, which is called WorkLite, and we're trying to use that philosophy really throughout the organization, so that organizations that depend on IBM are not waiting months or years or whatever for new capabilities to hit the market, that we're really responding to market conditions and doing it in a way that allows us to just keep building and then ship as needed.
Now, in Silicon Valley, early on in software companies, they used to have this position called the evangelist. And I think I'm wondering if what you're calling the social product manager may have been called an evangelist in the past. And certainly, there weren't all the tools that are available now for doing it.
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely. I got into IT, many, many years ago, and I was a customer of what was CC Mail at the time, which was then part of Lotus and then part of IBM, and that's kind of been my heritage. And I still remember by name the guy who was the CC Mail evangelist when that company started up in Mountain View. And, there's definitely an element of that. What I think is important, though, is that this isn't just stuff that evangelists and marketing people can use. The people actually making the decisions about the business have the opportunity to leverage some tools available to them today to get a better sense of what's going on in the market and encourage better participation from various communities internally and externally. If I think about a non-technology example like Starbucks, they have a website called mystarbucksidea.com right now that is providing some great innovation for them as an organization that is not coming from their own R&D department. It's coming from their customers. And that is a great way for product managers to get involved in the process of ideation and taking that input from the market and building better products and services.
Right. So there we're talking about crowdsourcing.
Crowdsourcing, yep.
Crowdsourcing for innovation, a lot of great tools. We talk about innovation pretty often. So let me see, we actually, have we covered the questions that I pre-tweeted out? Okay, so you've given us a sense of what the social product manager is, but what exactly is a social business?
Okay. So a social business is an organization that leverages all the social networking tools and techniques of social media in all of a company's processes, their business processes, both internal and external. It's taking people and connecting them with people, and then also people and connecting them with the process. So I consider it an organization that has encouraged a culture of participation and created this notion that everybody in the organization has the ability to participate in a conversation that will result in better ideas and better execution as a result of that participation. Now, participation doesn't mean everybody needs to talk. Not everybody needs to be a blogger or tweeter or Facebooker or whatever. Forrester has done this study on social software adoption for many years, and you know, they think only about 23-24% of people are actually going to create content on blogs or web pages or uploads or you know, that sort of element of participating in these sites. And there's a whole segment of the population, 50-60-70%, that are really going to be more spectators. But spectators are participants in a social software environment just the same as creators or critics or, you know, anybody else. So I worry sometimes people think that participation means your CEO has to be on Twitter, and I don't personally feel that that's the case.
And as I was saying, that this really started as a Twitter chat where we were doing the conversation on Twitter with the idea of breaking down barriers that anyone could, in an ideal world, if they had an internet connection, they could easily get onto Twitter and participate. And then quickly we found out that, gosh, thought leaders, just because people are communicating in one medium does not mean that they are comfortable communicating in another medium. And we shouldn't have that expectation. It's a lot of work to move someone from their comfort level with one tool to change your habits to use another tool.
That's right. And, you know, not everybody is kind of born to do that. There are definitely people who still, you know, want to use the tools that they're most familiar with or that they're going to be the most appropriate communicators using. In, you know, public companies, there's a whole different angle of regulated speech or things that could affect stock prices. And, you know, you have to think about those things as well. So I'm kind of comfortable with the notion that a social business is about engaging people. Doesn't mean about that it has to be about those people always speaking.
But it does mean that there are multiple opportunities to enable that conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's both a technical and a business decision to do that. It's, you know, it's a decision about how you want the culture of the company to operate and about what tools you make available to support that. But a lot of organizations, when they hear social as a buzzword today, think that's, I'll just buy a tool and everybody will start talking to each other. You have to have both.
Oh, gosh. I mean, that is the pain of the product manager. It's like getting people to use the tools that are now available. It's somewhat how I feel, oh, all we need is to have the tool and then it will work. No.
Right.
maybe that's the first step, is determining what the tool is, but that it shouldn't be the first step in thinking about what needs to happen in the organization to enable the communication. Don't start with the tool. Identify everything else and then arrive at what tool serves what the mission and the goals are within the organization, which I think is referring to the culture.
Yep. Yeah, I agree.
And so how do you take a massive organization and change the culture?
Yeah, there's a lot of steps to that. I mean, you definitely have to decide somewhere that there's going to be leadership. And sometimes it's a top-down, we really need this company to be different. And sometimes it's a bottom-up of grassroots. And sometimes it's a meet in the middle. And what we did at IBM is we saw the technology landscape changing and recognized at the grassroots that there needed to be an approach to that. And what we decided to do, and one of the things that I've, you know, never quite seen anybody do in the way that we did, is we went out and we decided as a group of people who were active in technology to go write a set of what were then blogging guidelines and have since become our social computing guidelines, which were a set of empowerment tools. It was the first time I've ever seen a policy document at IBM that said, we want you to do these things, and here's how we'll protect you if you do them right, and here's the things that, you know, you should look out for. It wasn't a thou shalt not kind of policy document, which is more common in our organization than I think in most organizations. And only after the people who had really been involved every day got together and wrote it did we go back to HR and finance and legal and get everybody in agreement that the straw man that we had come up with was really the right way to go. So very unusual process, but very successful. We've only had to update them twice, really, in any significant way since they were first written several years ago. And they're public on our website. If you go search on the IBM Social Computing Guidelines, you'll find a copy of them right on IBM.com that we think is, you know, best in class. And we use that then to launch a series of internal initiatives, which we now call the Digital IBMer. We got everybody from senior management down to get on board with the notion that these were tools that were going to be important to help transform IBM from a relatively faceless conglomerate into an organization where we're proud of and promoting our individuals.
That is so exciting to me, because IBM was a faceless. It wasn't a personal. It was the epitome of, hardware technology pre-internet. I remember probably before your time, it was nobody ever got fired for buying an IBM.
Sure, I remember that when we were acquired.
It was a standard, but it certainly didn't represent a personable brand at all. It was about technology, and being the best and being the first and even being the biggest.
Yeah, that's
so
right. It's great.
to shift that into a, this is a, would you say a responsive organization? Like, how did you distill down what that brand vision is?
That's a good question. I think that a lot of work has gone on in the last couple of years to make IBM stand for something in the market. We stand for a smarter planet. We stand for, you know, being focused on the client. There's some really, really core values that have been established, and those have been admittedly primarily top-down kinds of initiatives. But then we've married that with the set of tools available to us, and then what the result is that you start to see us, focus on the individual and getting our expertise out into the market and, you know, really recognizing the way to connect to a customer on that level. All over our website, we have links to humans. If you go to ibm.com/software, there's a profile of some experts on that page that we want customers to connect with over Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and blogs and other tools like that. And we make it one click easy to find those people. So even though it's a huge company with lots of resources, we've recognized that if we can expose those experts outside the walls, that we'll start better conversations with customers. And then in turn, we're also building digital eminence through the same process. I know who the people are that know something about a particular topic, both because we have expertise location tools, but also because they're now in the habit of working out loud and sharing what they know.
Excellent. It was very exciting. So let me ask you a question that I don't know if you can or want to answer, so feel free to. But if someone wanted to become a product manager at IBM, because they're attracted to everything that you're talking about in this, it just seems like a great organization. Certainly, I know used to definitely invest in its personnel, education and training and everything else. So if someone wanted to become a product manager at IBM, how would they do that?
Yeah, we've taken product managers into the discipline from all over the organization, from, you know, development or marketing or technical support or, you know, sort of from everywhere. And the real key to, you know, to being a successful product manager is understanding how to translate what we build and do into something that the market wants or needs. That ability to talk on both the technical level and the business level sort of is the defining factor for a product manager. The engineers can stay technical and the marketing people can stay focused on business value. And the product manager is kind of the interface between the two. And, you know, that allows that person to be in a position to talk to anybody in a prospective organization or an existing client. So the transformation can happen into product management in a lot of different ways. We've also, you know, hired people from the outside into the discipline, especially to be more on the business side of pricing and packaging and routes to market and channel development and ecosystem, you know, components of being a product manager.
So if somebody wasn't currently a product manager, people ask me this all the time. What might you advise them to do if they wanted to get into product management?
I would advise them to really, you know, have an understanding of business plans, like go look at some Harvard case studies or, you know, similar things from marketing textbooks in universities that, you know, really look at how businesses are succeeding or failing based on decisions that they're making. I think that, you know, that understanding of the whole business picture, not just the, you know, case study that focused on one element of how did a company arrive at a brand name or something like that, but much bigger picture of how did a market get entered or how did that market expand. Those are interesting case studies to sort of build up your own knowledge and really think about it as a brand or portfolio ownership. At times, some of our executives call product management execs mini CEOs of their own business. And so if you adopt that sort of mindset, now, not every company works that way. Some are marketing-driven cultures and some are development-driven cultures. And, you know, I'm not even sure that we do all the time, but it's an interesting approach to think about how you really are using the decision-making process to bring a product or service to market or update it and be successful in that regard.
Excellent. And to your point that different companies have different cultures, strategies, methods, do you think there is the right way? I mean, there was always this desire to see these trends in management and, you know, agile, and that's the panacea today. But do you think there is one right way that if every organization applied this, it would guarantee success? A very leading question here.
There's never one right way, no. I think there are companies that do social business really well. I think there are companies that do their development process really well, and they live in very different worlds, right? There's companies that are never social and are still very, very successful. And there are companies that are all about social and they may or may not be successful. For me, the real keys are having an audience to talk to that you can engage on an individual level in some way. That can hold true for consumer products. You know, I tweeted with the at Home Depot ID over the weekend and got a response within seconds, so that's great. That builds some brand loyalty and affinity. But if they didn't have anybody listening, I'd probably still shop at Home Depot. But, maybe it makes me feel better about the brand and more affiliated with it. So I think there's a lot of decisions that go into play, and you have to think about who your audience is and what message you're trying to communicate, just the same as any other tool. And if you make those decisions right, things will be successful.
Excellent. So drilling down in, we actually had this as Q3, and my hands are tied. I'm not tweeting and talking here.
Okay.
hopefully I'm doing a good job of the what I'm doing. But we did have posted for Q3, how does an individual product manager affect their marketplace?
That's a good question. I think an individual product manager can affect their marketplace by having a unique and authentic voice. So those are maybe two separate concepts, but by engaging in the market and carrying something that's really worthwhile for people to tune into. And my experience was that as the product management owner for a product within IBM that had a fairly large but distributed market, wasn't necessarily the market leader, but a lot of companies were using it around the world, that if I shared information that companies weren't getting necessarily anywhere else, and I could do it in a much more informal way than our web pages or our press releases, and I could do it more timely as a result, then I could talk to customers directly. And what we've seen is that when we measure conversions on our website, people coming into IBM.com, it's rare that customers end up on our front doorstep when they're looking to buy something now. They typically are going into a search engine and they're looking for human-related information, curated content. They might eventually get to IBM.com with an offer in hand to download something or register for a webcast or something like that. And through my blog and Twitter channel and some other vehicles that we measured, we actually found that the conversion rate was much higher when a human came into our website through me than through, and this is data that's about a year old, but then came through our newsletters or some of our more formal marketing tools. So something about that curation, that authentic voice of there's a human standing behind this and I can figure out that human's reputation, made for a much more successful set of engagements with the customer. And so the product manager can, really affect the marketplace by bringing customers into the funnel, but then they can also communicate back out and, indicate product ideas, test those ideas, communicate futures. I even use it to find appointments when I'm on the road. So if I identify that I'm going to be traveling in the Bay Area next month, and I put that on my Twitter stream or on my LinkedIn, I'm sure to get two or three meeting opportunities that are probably useful ones that develop just straight out of me directly making myself available.
Nice. So you're saying actually it requires a human opening up the conversation, so it's human to human. It's like an individual cannot really interact with an organization,
but putting
a human face. So you do a lot of blogging yourself, and that's what opens the channel.
Yeah, blogging, tweeting, Facebooking. I use everything pretty much at this point. So.
And when you do a blog post, does that help you sync with what might be the content marketing strategy or point or theme of the month? Or do you have to go through marketing to sync with them, or you can just post whatever you'd like?
I don't typically work with marketing on I work with marketing because I now am sort of straddling the line and doing a marketing role. But as a product manager, I didn't typically work with marketing to write blog content because I wanted to make sure it was in my own voice. But I'd work with marketing on themes like, this month we're going to focus on this particular product attribute or release or new concept. And if you do that, then you can get the same message going through multiple channels and, present more of a united set of messages to the market. The blog then becomes just one tool. But on the other hand, sort of independent of that, if I was working on, version 10 of a product, I might have that conversation just directly in the market to get ideas and opportunities around that release, out into the market and understand what we could or should be doing you know, overall in the market.
Excellent. So I just want to say that you're listening to the Global Product Management Talk. This is Cindy F. Solomon. I am talking with Ed Brill, who is an IBM executive. We're talking about becoming the social product manager. And we're just now going to get into talking about Ed's book, Opting In. But you can follow us at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK and search for that acronym, PRODMGMTTALK, to find us on the web and for upcoming broadcasts, Twitter chats, and in-person meetups at startupproduct.com. So let's talk about opting in, which, why don't you give us like a lead in lessons in social business from Fortune 500 product manager. What had you write the book, and how long did it take? How do you suggest that product managers should publish? Is this now an additional part requirement for advancing in the profession?
No, I don't think it is at all. I came to write the book because we at IBM, in establishing our own practice around social business as a market opportunity, we recognized that highlighting that digital IBMer in the market was a way to establish some credibility and some authenticity. So coming out of a town hall with some of our senior executives a year ago, I sat down and said, okay, let's see if there's a story here. And some of this is a decade's worth of examples of how we used external communications of a social business nature, or social networking nature, to make decisions. And so I thought it was a pretty useful story. And IBM Press is an imprint of Pearson, so we have an arm into publishing. And I worked with Pearson to come up with a proposal and go through the process of writing. We had a conference back in January of this year that we wanted to have the hard copy version of the book available for that conference, so that became a forcing function for the deadline and therefore working backwards. So I wrote the manuscript in about 100 days. That's not typical. That's fast, and I had to run my business during the day as well. But it was really an opportunity to get the book done and out in the market and start some conversations about what does it mean to be a social business and a social product manager, and tell some of the stories and the lessons learned over the last decade that we've had in market experience at IBM, and get that out. And you know, the book is very candid. It's not all happy talk or fluffy stories or wonderful examples. There's some failures in there too, and that's the scars of how we did this right and sometimes wrong, and I'm okay with that. I don't lose sleep over the fact that we were candid in the book. I want it to be an authentic and unique voice, just like I talk about in terms of the context of social business. So
I want to underline that point, which I would tweet, so I'll tweet after the fact. But authentic, an authentic voice, and a candid voice, not usually descriptions associated with big multinational corporations.
That's true. That is true. But you know, it was very important to me to have that kind of tone of voice for the book, because I think that, you know, there is a place in the market where if you are transparent and, you know, speak with the reality of a situation, that will engage more people. I felt like if we were telling the story of where we did things right and wrong, that was much more credible, and that people would want to do business with us more than if we were always engaged in a sunshiny, happy world of everything being wonderful and us always doing great things. There is a story in the book, and it's an iterative story of a product I released about 2 years ago where I didn't get it right the first time. In fact, it was a new release of an old product that had been in market for several years, had a lot of feedback from our ecosystem and our partners about things that I could do to change that product and make it better. I made those changes very incrementally, and it was a mistake. I should have just made them all at once. And every time I made one of the incremental changes, I got feedback, oh, well, that was nice, but how about these other three things that you could do? And so it took a long time to really get to a point where everybody in the market was happy. But once we did, we grew that product by several million dollars over a year-to-year basis. So you can make the right decisions out in the public eye, you know, open and in the light. And oftentimes that feedback, though certainly not your own only feedback mechanism, will prove to be a very validating one and a very realistic set of voices.
Excellent. So what kind of tools, and do you have a suggestion for the best tools that are available and should be implemented for social product managers?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody will find their own, and there's obviously a lot of social listening tools that are out there. But ultimately, you want to go where your customers and your partners are, where your community is, or you want to create that community. So we sell community-oriented tools. There are a lot of other companies in the market that do as well. But I also believe in going to slideshare.net and YouTube and Facebook fan pages and Twitter and, you know, all sorts of other, you know, vehicles where you don't have to build up the infrastructure or the audience. You can just participate in vehicles that are already there. So I think if you start with some social listening, even just simple things like Google Alerts to keep track of where conversations are happening in the market, then, you know, you can really choose where to engage and be successful in doing so.
Are you using any sophisticated tools? Because that's certainly one of the things that I do with the Global Product Management Talk is to post at every venue where the audience may be, and I find that people have different preferences for where they want to engage, but then it becomes difficult. How do you maintain every different venue? It's like the plant your flag strategy, but then you have to nurture every community in every different environment.
Yeah. I don't pretend to know the best tools or the only tools. We use some that we've developed in-house, like our IBM Connections platform. We have some tools for consumer insight that we've developed and sell. We work with some third-party vendors and some agencies. So there's a range of things coming my own way. In a B2B market, like I serve at IBM, the pool of people to listen to and the conversations to have and the places to go are much smaller. I often try to put myself in a McDonald's mindset. I think McDonald's is a company that's done a really great job of using social media to reach consumers and really rehabilitate their image. That, and if anybody from McDonald's is listening, a shout out on doing the calorie count thing very early sort of convinced people that, hey, our food is actually healthier than you think it is. And, you know, I see that they've really had a resurgence as a result of making their business much more transparent, using social as a set of channels to do that.
Yes, and they made a couple of heinous mistakes along the way, but recovered.
Yes, well, sure, right. Nobody's done this perfectly. I ended up on the cover of Forbes magazine on an article in 2005 called Attack of the Blogs. Not really how I ever wanted to end up in Forbes, but hey, look, Mom, I'm in Forbes magazine. it was in the early days when blogs were seen as an evil brand attacking machine. And yet I think in the end, you know, if that reporter came back and tried to write that same story in 2013, they would have to start with a whole different premise that blogs have been a successful and useful tool for business. So
you got misrepresented in Forbes. Did it hurt you in any way? I mean, in the short term, or it sounds like you capitalized on being mentioned in Forbes is better than not being mentioned.
Any publicity is a good publicity, right? No, I don't know that that was actually all that helpful at the time. There was a lot of angst, but then there were a lot of people on the side of the truth and the future that, you know, this is 2005, so it was a long time ago, that saw that social as a good thing and came to the side of those of us who had been condemned in the story. So, you know, Dan Gilmore, who was writing for the Mercury News at the time and is now at University of Arizona, I think, you know, he wrote a book called We the Media shortly thereafter, and basically, you know, came down on the side that this openness and transparency was going to be the future. And you look at it in almost every walk of life, in, you know, some of the, you know, amazing stuff out of the Arab Spring and the transparency of elections all over the world and some of the culture change in just humanity in general, you know, social media has definitely changed the face of the planet today. So I don't feel like blogs as an attack vehicle is really a story that would play in 2013 the same way that it did in Forbes in 2005.
For sure, and also with the embracing of fail publicly and fail fast.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of forgiveness.
That's right. And I think transparency and forgiveness go hand in hand a little bit. If you're open and candid about decisions and situations, then I think that the buying public will take that at much more face value.
Right. And right, it's a matter of how you position it. So Q5, and I think we're speaking to it. What are some of the risks associated with product management and social business?
Yeah, there are some blind spots that you have to avoid or at least be conscious of when you think about using social business tools in the context of product management. One is, you know, there's a subset risk, which is populations or demographics or languages. Most of my social media participation is in English. I have done a little bit in Spanish, but I'm not doing any in Mandarin or in Japanese or, you know, Arab subcontinent. So there are some whole markets where if their command of the English language isn't, you know, a primary one, they're not participating in the same conversation that I'm in. So, you know, I think that there's a need to have others that participate or some other way to get that input from markets that you're not seeing. There's also a demographic that's not participating online and, you know, could equally be a risk of a blind spot. There's a risk of unintended audiences. You might be having a conversation with somebody on Twitter that you think is, you know, written in the right tone of voice for that person that you're talking to. And yet, you know, that could get completely misconstrued and blown up on you if you're not understanding the fact that it's a public conversation. I think there's a risk of emotion. The, you know, need for an authentic voice sometimes boils over into letting the trolls get to you or whatever. So I think that, you know, there's an important balancing act between appearing human and using your unique voice and yet at the same time not getting too emotional in the context of your interactions. And I think that there's an internal tension in a lot of organizations over what you're disclosing or paying attention to or priorities, where you could have things that are, you know, taking place as a public conversation that maybe not everybody internally is on board with. So, you know, you have to decide your level of tolerance for that kind of an engagement.
Excellent. I want to give a shout-out to our tweeters, Alicia Dixon at Special LI 1972 who is a loyal fan and excellent tweeter. She's underlining some of your points. She says, "Wow, Ed Brill wrote opting in part time in less than 100 days, and that got retweeted. So that's a big point." And also, Alicia is a product manager in Virginia, I believe, and she is coming on the show next week to talk about how to become a product manager at a different stage in your career. So great, and I'll pull up when I see other tweeters. So great. You actually gave us an excellent list of what the risks involved are. Now, are those also outlined in the book?
Yeah, absolutely. Chapter 10 of the book is all about risk, or 9 or 10. I got it wrong here, maybe. But yeah, everything we just talked about is part of the book. So, yeah.
Excellent. Great. So how do you think that product management will evolve or continue to evolve? So this is a two-part question. It's product management as a discipline, but I'm always thinking of product managers as individual professionals as well.
Yeah. I think, you know, there's a couple of things. One is I think product managers in the future, as a result of their knowledge of the business, will be more directly aligned with business management and oversight. I think that that's a real potential. In a lot of companies, product managers sit within a development organization or something like that, and maybe they'll, you know, sort of be able to rise out onto their own responsibilities and their own visibility in the company. I think product managers in the future will be able to be more inclusive of all markets and languages and cultures. So some of the things that we just talked about as risks, I think, will get solved. And then ultimately, I think that product managers will just, you know, be able to make better and faster decisions as a result of the tools that are available. You know, a lot of what when I started in product management back in 99 was my first product management job. I think a lot of product management decisions were gut instinct. And, you know, now there's data that can support it. It can be anecdotal data, but at least you can get data going quickly and, you know, really have that culture of participation.
Excellent. And yes, so, you know, operating from the gut, I mean, right, that's a no-no. Number one,
yeah.
No-no. It's been adopted in Steve Blank's and, you know, Eric Ries, get out of the building and don't make any decisions without data and without customer feedback. Or at least have that to back up what you think is your gut instinct, but never be biased without proof. So here is a question from Alicia, who is tweeting. What are your thoughts on managing social business along with personal social media? And so she's apologizing if she missed your answer. You did speak a little bit to it in terms of how you changed the culture at IBM to make it more transparent. But I think she may be asking managing social business along with personal social media.
That's important. I personally have struggled with this. I have one Twitter ID where five different versions of Ed Brill converge. There's, you know, me as an IBM executive. There's me as a traveler and foodie as well. We started the call with that as well. And there's me as a writer for a local blog here in the town that I live in. You know, so a lot of my interests converge on a single Twitter ID. And I don't know if I did it over again, if that would be the right way to do it. But, you know, I've kind of built a decent following there. So I don't want to kind of go try to segment that market after the fact. But, you know, people who have an opportunity to tweet and not just Twitter, blog, and all these other things within a business context, have to remember that humans want to do business with humans, and you don't want to be a purely one-dimensional, you know, sort of tone of voice in those business contexts. So I think it's important, and I talk about it in the book a bit, to sell yourself as well as your product and company in the context of the social media that you're using, because otherwise people just don't want to engage. So even on multi-user Twitter IDs, I think it's important to have some ability to be conversational and human in the context of the interactions. For somebody who's trying to build their own individual eminence and brand, you know, that's a little harder. But I think that there's some opportunities to do that, you know, again, through having an authentic and unique voice and expanding that into the right audience.
Yeah, and I did the opposite of what you did. You know, I have a different Twitter handle for the various entities that I'm involved with. I even have different Facebooks because my family was not interested in my product management endeavors. and it's just difficult to manage everything. And also, I found that people didn't associate. I thought it was better to remove myself from the, you know, various communities. So I wasn't kind of driving the community, and then but people wanted it. So I don't know if there's a right answer. I think it's contextual. But maybe the place to start with is that definitely with humans want to interact with humans, and everything else is just a tool to enable that interaction.
Yep, that's right.
So. Yeah, but it's hard being human sometimes. So, in a B2B world, but less so. So I appreciate the work that you're doing to dehumanize the B2B world. It's really excellent in the authentic candidacy. It also opens up the attractiveness for, you know, younger people at the beginning of their career to look at bigger organizations, that there is a place for them to contribute from their values without losing faith, quote unquote.
Yeah, I agree.
So excellent. And Ed, we're coming to the end of the hour. I want to tell people, what's the best way for them to get your book? And also, if you could restate the URLs, I want to go, if people didn't come in until later, about the where the principles are of the social media IBM principles.
Sure.
Are, and also if those are available for copying.
Yeah, right. So the IBM Social Computing Guidelines are at ibm.com/blogs/ZZ. I don't know why. I think that should be enough URL to get there. But if you just go to Google and type in IBM Social Computing Guidelines, it wasn't quite enough to get there. So go to Google and type in IBM Social Computing Guidelines, and you'll end up with them. And they're public. We've encouraged other companies to use them as a best practice, and we've seen other companies adopt them, you know, kind of completely wholesale. For the book, Opting In Lessons in Social Business, it's on Amazon. I think right now probably one of the lowest prices is on Amazon. Or you can go with the bit.ly/OPTING IN, so opting in camel case, and use discount code BRILL, and you get about the same price for that from IBM Press Books. Kindle version is out there as well as iBooks and everything else. And I think we said we would give one away to a listener if you want. We could happily do that.
Okay. So let's see. Let me see. Of our tweeters, usually do that after the fact, but I think...
Yeah, we could do that. We could do it off the air, too. That's totally fine, but we'll happily give one away.
Okay, because I need some time to see who the lurkers were and
yeah.
Right. Who the listeners were. So, yeah, we will give one book away. And so if you want to game the system and email me, it's Cindy@PRODMGMTTALK.com, and tell me how much you enjoyed having Ed Brill on the call today. You will be put into the, if we have to do a drawing for who wins the book. Now, the discount code, if they go to bit.ly/OPTINGIN, and the discount code is?
Brill, which is my last name.
Brill, B-R-I-L-L. Okay, great. Awesome. Thank you so much, Ed, for being on the show today and calling in. We're both in Chicago, but not in the same location. So this has been great. Definitely let me know when you're in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Of course.
Yeah, so we can meet you in person and have you speak at Startup Product Talks Meetup. By the way, our listeners, please follow us at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. For Alicia Dixon is on next week. I am traveling. I'm heading towards Boston and stopping in some beautiful cities along the way. So you can tweet me at Cindy F. Solomon, S-O-L-O-M-O-N, if you'd like to meet. And I just learned that I should, I just learned to do that from Ed. So thank you, Ed.
Yes, thank you for having this opportunity.
Yeah, so great. So the recording will be available on Blog Talk Radio, and the Twitter transcript will be up, as well as Rev.com is a startup in San Francisco, and they are doing our transcripts of the talk. So all the information will be available to read as well. So thank you so much to our listeners. Thank you to our speaker, Ed, and have a great week. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you, Cindy.
Okay, take care.